The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Afternoon. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
Bill Pendiff.
And our producer, Bob Martin, who's pushing a lot of buttons over there and has been rendered mute.
Oh, he's a button-pushing fool right now. Let him go.
We've been, it's like, call this person, no. Call that person, no. We're switching.
Hut.
It's that kind of morning, afternoon. Feels like morning. It's the first thing we've done official today. So,
speak for yourself.
Well, I know. The ambassador's been on stage somewhere.
I've been planning the show, and I've been busy.
It's Sunday. God knows you're lying.
Oh, okay.
You're in trouble. Oh, my gosh. So, in all the insanity, we are being joined by Ambassador Francis Rooney this morning. He has an article that is actually in The Hill, and I'm sure it appeared elsewhere, but I listed the one from The Hill. It's ISIS, Islamic Extremism and the Long War. And, geez Louise, I mean, that has been all over the news, if you could get past Baltimore, actually.
And you've got that on the website.
And that is on the website.
It's a great article. I just read it last night, and I got a ton of questions.
Well, that's good. So you can find that online at wethepeopleradio.us, which is where you'll find all the information on our guests and archives and all that good stuff. And there is also a button there at the top of the page where we are chatting and streaming live here this hour. So, without further ado, Ambassador Rooney, where were you speaking today?
I'm speaking from Florida Gulf Coast University. I just did a graduation speech, and I'm going to do another one at 5 o'clock.
Oh, that's it. I was like, wow, you have to do some kind of speaking on Sunday. That figures graduation. I forgot. Oh, my gosh. So, so much for retirement. You've...
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't sound like a lot of retirement to me.
A little pipe dream for you?
Yeah, there's plenty going on with me. How about you all?
It's a good time, I guess, to be in radio. There's no shortage of topic.
No, and the world, as I just told those kids, the same thing you were just talking about. The world's a turbulent place with unprecedented challenges, many of which relate to this Middle Eastern stuff, many of it relates to globalization and in some ways a challenging, but in some ways a fascinating time to be a college graduate.
Yeah, I guess so. It's like, where are you going to fit in and what's it going to look like once you get there? I think, what kinds of things do they ask you?
Well, the good thing about giving a graduation speech is they don't get to ask you anything.
Right, but I mean, don't they, like, chase you down afterwards?
Oh, yeah, they do that. And they're mostly just thankful. Thankful to have the talk, and you know, they're very appreciative, they're very excited to get to meet a few of the families. It's graduation speeches are upbeat moments because you've got all these families there seeing their children. This is a school where about half or a third of the kids are first generation college attendees.
Oh, wow!
So there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of families, and it's really heartwarming to see.
That's kind of great because those guys have the potential to actually fix this mess. I'm sure that was part
exactly.
of your message.
You bet. They're the change agents. I always like to close with that quote from Theodore Roosevelt about dare, far better it is to dare mighty things and vainglorious triumphs rather than take rank with those poor souls who neither suffer much nor enjoy much.
That
amen.
Is, yeah, it's like, what do you say after that? Yeah, amen. Good one.
One of the things you stated in your article, you had one line in there that really kind of grabbed me. It said, not since the communist state of Stalin or perhaps the Third Reich have we faced such a potential or at least self-proclaimed existential threat to the modern world. And, boy, that really says a lot and really hits home, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me. That's why I wrote the article. I'm just getting kind of tired of the president and a lot of liberals talking about this organized hegemonic terror by ISIS and unorganized hegemonic terror by Al-Qaeda, describing it as some kind of series of random criminal acts. this is a, to me, it is a warlike condition that, that requires a warlike response from the world. And it involves soft diplomacy, it involves containment, it involves military action by, certainly by the people who have a better chance of success than we have had. And you deploy all tools of statecraft to try to interdict it and ultimately undermine it.
Well, I think if you look at where ISIS was a year ago compared to where they are today, I think it's pretty easy to say we're not winning that battle, are we?
I'm not sure we are winning it, and I'm not sure we even know how bad we may be losing it, because I don't think we know how this recruitment and radicalization process is working. You know, we keep hearing instances of Americans even becoming radicalized of all socioeconomic strata, not just people in prison and the marginalized poor, becoming radicalized and enthused by these terrorists to go fight against the United States in Syria and Iraq and many more from the UK, in fact.
Well, have we ever had this in our past where American citizens are leaving our country to join a foreign power like this? I mean, did that even happen? I guess it happened during World War II, but
they weren't planning
on coming back. And well, yeah, that.
Okay, except for Jane Fonda.
But it's really kind of a phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever happened other than, like you say, the few that there were anti-war protesters in the Vietnam War, but they didn't leave the country. They just stayed right here and had
right.
their sit-ins. And you might have had a few Japanese or Germans that became counterintelligence agents for their respective countries. I don't know. But this is, to me, unprecedented. And I think it's unprecedented that the administration has refused to call these guys enemy combatants, raise the definition of the conflict to the level of a war, as President Bush tried to do, therefore apply the international law norms of warlike conduct, not random criminal activity. These guys that go over there and fight certainly don't deserve Fourth Amendment rights. They don't deserve any rights that any other foreigner deserves that's fighting the United States.
Well, no. When you leave the country and join a foreign power, I think officially or unofficially, you have pretty much given up your citizenship, and you're going to have to go by the rules of war at that point.
But even the guys that aren't citizens, they're giving them access to constitutional privileges that obviously they don't deserve.
And I think that's maybe even worse.
Well, again, if it's a war, then I think enemy combatant rules apply. Things like Guantanamo and other containment and internment facilities have more legitimacy.
Absolutely. You talked about in your article, and I thought it was really interesting, how you said we have to work with the moderate Muslims and give them a seat at the table as far as negotiating with these guys over there, because they're not going to listen to the United States if there's not Muslims speaking on our behalf. And did I get that right?
Yeah, I kind of make the argument that, like, if you look at it like Pavlov's hierarchy of needs, you know, a secular state has, you know, standard of righteousness and principles in its foreign policy. A non-secular sovereign like the Holy See or the UN sometimes has an even different level of respect and for its positions because it's not a secular threat. And then when you have a religion that can unite, or religions that can unite, and try to discuss how another religion, the Muslim one, should operate, I think they have more inherent credibility than a state. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, I think you've got to have the vast majority of Muslims who are secular and decent people and are not radicalized become enthused to oppose the hijacking of their religion, the mutation of their doctrine, into a radicalized criminal situation.
And that part is always the part that catches me. It's like, how did these guys just sit by and watch it? And basically they're marginalized because of it. I don't know. You'd think they would step up with some sort of force.
Well, in a lot of cases, they're not even willing to fight. They want somebody else to do it.
Well, there's a...
See, I think both on both fronts, on both the ideological public opinion front as well as on the boots on the ground front. We have been appeasement oriented, and we have been willing to do their fighting for them. I think two of the points of Pope Benedict's Regensburg speech and that Pope Francis has been saying recently are still very important, that the Muslims need to take responsibility for their religion, and they need to figure out how to draw it into consensus with the modern world. That the modern world is not going to return to 10th century behavior. They have to take the 10th century language out of their Quran or ignore it and focus on the parts of the Quran that are more, would you say, apostolic or religious oriented, pastoral.
How likely is that to happen on a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, okay, what if the United States, if we weren't quite willing so bend over backwards to accommodate Muslims and not want to hurt anybody's feelings to the point where we'll do school field trips to mosques but not synagogues or churches? I think maybe we just ought to treat Muslims like everybody else, and therefore when their behavior is not good, we should call them out, and when their behavior is good, we should be thankful for it. There are some institutions in this country that have reportedly, and I think it's true, been infiltrated or at least under the influence of some bad Muslim groups like Muslim Brotherhood. And I think those should be called out. One particular one is CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations. And then the other thing we should focus on is imams in the United States and the people that go listen to them. Pew Research put out some statistics that 85% of imams in the United States are foreign-born. A little scary, and that 26% of those have openly opposed the United States way of life. It's been printed in the Wall Street Journal. And so to me, I say, wow, that's very dangerous for young people to be exposed to that many potentially radicalizing imams. So free speech would say the imam's free to say what he wants, but wartime surveillance would say the FBI should really know who's listening to them and pay close attention to where they're moving around.
Yeah, we ought to take them at their word. We've got to take a really quick break here. We will be back in 2 minutes. We are being joined by Ambassador Rooney. He's taking a little break between college graduation speeches and joining us on the topic of Islamic extremism, which we can't discuss enough. We're here at We the People Radio. Join us online, please. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Too many questions.
Too many questions, too little time. Welcome back to We the People Radio. Thought we'd throw in a little,
levity?
John Travolta. you can't think about it without seeing the John Travolta dance.
Yeah, and the white pants.
Yeah, not good. Those people in college that the ambassador was talking to, they have no idea why we're even laughing. Good for them. Join us online at WeThePeopleRadio.us. We're back with Ambassador Rooney. And we have a caller on the line. We have David, who has a quick question for you. We know your time is limited, Mr. Ambassador, so we will keep her short. David?
Yeah. Greetings from San Francisco. You know, I wanted to ask you if you were familiar with the origins of ISIS as it ties to the mineral companies, the oil companies, and Saudi Prince Bandar.
Not specifically ISIS, but I know that several of the Saudi princes have been involved in funding al-Qaeda, from which ISIS seems to have sprung. And they even founded, some of Osama bin Laden's people. It's a problem for me that Saudi Arabia in particular has been willing to help bad people and export Wahhabism around the world in order to keep peace at home. It's almost like a Faustian bargain. And I think that's come home to roost now. On the other hand, it's good to at least see that Saudi Arabia is finally starting to speak up and oppose terrorism and even try to marshal some fighting forces and airplanes in Yemen and in Iraq.
Well, thanks for that question, David. Hey, one question I had on what we were talking about earlier was, how do we get the trust of the American public with, you know, like right now we have some Muslims that are in our administration, and you hear a little bit about that, but
ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, not just, you know.
Well, that too. But if we're going to have a Muslim coalition speaking and trying to bring some sort of peace, how do we get the American public to trust the Muslims that are speaking on our behalf when they can lie, according to their Quran?
You know, I think Americans are the most trusting and decent people on earth. And what we've seen lately is maybe almost too much willingness to trust.
Oh, I agree.
Not enough willingness to look under the covers and say, what is Muslim American Foundation? What is CARE? What are what kind of military chaplains are they recommending that the military hire? What kind of, when they give support to some of these local demonstrations and things, what's their agenda? In this kind of dangerous world, I would argue that, like I say, if we're in a war, your paranoia level becomes heightened and you tend to look under the rocks a little closer.
Well, I doubt we ever finish this. I don't think this is a finish. I know it's not a word, but I don't think it's finishable.
I think it's going to take a long time, but ultimately everything seems to get resolved. But I think it's going to take, it has a better chance of being resolved sooner when the countries around the radicalized areas become more engaged. When we are careful about our engagement and only become engaged in the areas where we can affect the outcome. And the entire Western world realizes that the ability for free movement of radicalized people or people who are susceptible to radicalization, going to countries where radical terrorism is taking place, is a bad thing. And then we can start to restrict people moving around these countries.
Well, it seems that, I mean, really, when you look around, you look at policies, you look at things that are happening here in the U.S., it's very anti-Christian. And this ISIS business and whoever they want to call themselves really feeds on that.
Yeah, they do. And what they have found is that the more heinous their criminality can be, and the broader it can be shown on YouTube and things like that, the more value they derive, both in using as a recruitment tool for people who are susceptible to radicalization, as well as a fear installation tool to further shock and paralyze the Western world. And I think, we might not be able to change the former, but we can certainly change the latter.
Sure. And what would you say to, you know, we have so many people that just get, you know, it reminds me of Vietnam again. You know, they just get screwed up about what side they're on and what's actually at stake. And, you know, they actually feel sorry for these guys.
Well, that's that appeasement I've kind of mentioned in earlier. I think that, and that's why it's great to see candid speaking like the Pope's. That's why I think the idea of recruiting other religious leaders to speak up would be a healthy idea. Same thing President Truman tried unsuccessfully in 1952. To have more voices speaking up, calling on Muslims in particular, but other scholars to criticize this kind of behavior and give some cover to say, an imam that's willing to step up.
And do you think the Pope's doing enough, our current Pope? Do you think he's being outspoken enough about it? Because now he's, like, launching off on something with global warming or something, climate change.
Yeah. If there's a problem with the Pope,
oh my gosh,
it's that he may fight too many fronted wars right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I realize this isn't our topic, but, you know, the climate change thing bugged me. When I know he didn't actually speak out on it, but, you know, the part of his, I don't know what, you know, you would know what you call it, but his guys did, that they think climate change is real and all that. How much weight's that going to have?
Well, both Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis have spoken up to some degree about it, because I think they're kind of adopting the Eurocentric mentality that it's science is a foregone conclusion. When I'm not sure about that. I'm not a scientist, but I know a lot of smart people, scientists that say it's some elements of the climate change debate are unproved. I mean, I don't think anybody would doubt that huge amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere is not necessarily a good thing, that pollution's not a good thing, and that finding cleaner energy as part of the overall energy solution is a useful endeavor. But that doesn't mean that we're going to impose radical growth impeding policies that take food off of people's plate to try to accomplish something that may not be justified.
Yeah, I keep hoping that Pope Francis will be drawn in, you know, taken away from it, actually. He'll be engaged by the fact that it's going to just create more poverty.
That's what I think they need to focus on, because they're advocating something which is inconsistent with the other part of the things they advocate.
Yeah, you can't be anti-poverty and then create policy that creates it. Tell me this, how engaged can the Pope be? I know that Pope John Paul was really, really, he was a big part of our Cold War, you know, the ending of our Cold War. How much of a deal can Pope Francis affect, do you think?
Well, we've seen him have a bit of an effect on this Cuba thing, right or wrong, whether you agree with it or not. He certainly was effective in using the convening power of the Holy See to bring the United States and Cuba together in a way that kept the press out of it long enough that they could achieve some sort of meeting of the minds. I'm a little skeptical as to whether this administration will make the kind of good deal that we need in Cuba to protect freedom, transparency, human rights, et cetera. But the principle of the Holy See's engagement, I think, is pretty dramatic. So it can have an effect. I think he's moved the needle a little bit on Islamic terrorism. I think Pope Benedict might have moved it more with his Regensburg speech, but they need to keep speaking up and encouraging other religious leaders to do it. Hopefully it'll get some traction.
Well, and as the ambassador, how much effect are you able to have? I realize it depends on the person and the Pope and, you know, the circumstance, but is it a place where you can weigh in?
Yeah. When I was over there, and I'm sure Ambassador Hackett's doing the same thing, we would meet with the Holy See people three or four times a week about different issues that the State Department would want to raise with them, or to get their feedback on things they wanted to raise with us. And that's kind of the routine diplomatic interchange. And I think that because certainly under George Bush, the alignment of fundamental personal principles was so strong with the Holy See's fundamental diplomatic principles, there was great willingness to kind of bend over backwards to listen to our message and to try to take positions that were aligned with our message. I don't know how much of that's been the case recently. You know, there's some divergence between the administration and the Holy See on many issues, even though they have seemed to have worked in alignment on this Cuba one.
Yeah, I wonder about that. You were there in a time when we were kind of all on the same page, really.
That's right.
Very, very different. Do they ever call you up and see what you think, or are you just a retired guy that was already there?
No, I talked to them a lot, and especially in writing the book. I made a lot of trips there and spent a great deal of time with Holy See officials in writing the book. And, they were very helpful in that regard, by the way.
Well, that's
they wanted to see the story told.
That's kind of great. So we know you have to go back and. I don't know, probably travel to another spot for your next graduation speech. But any thoughts you'd leave people with?
Well, I think that the biggest thing that I would say, which was the idea of that article, is that we are in a war. And we have to look at the conflicts that we're facing from radical terrorists broadly. Just like President Uribe realized what he had on his hands with the FARC and took very radical measures to finally bring them to a point of debility where President Santos may actually be able to create conditions for peace. There's an analogy to what we need to do with the radicalized terrorists in what happened in Colombia.
We had a question in the chat. who now influences the direction of the Pope? Well, I think we know where he gets most of his direction, but are there people that have political influence over what he announces publicly?
Well, you know, the Pope and the Secretary of State organization operate in foreign policy much like the United States. I mean, he gets advice from the Secretary of State, who, by the way, is one of the truly smartest diplomats in the Holy See's diplomacy, Cardinal Parolin. Mm-hmm. And then they have Monsignors under them that are country experts, like our State Department desk officers are. And so he gets a wide range of information so that they can make decisions on the basis of different inputs and try to avoid too much unilateral action.
When you were speaking to them, when you getting information for writing the book, did you find that they had insight and information that wasn't generally public knowledge?
Oftentimes they do. And in fact, I put some examples in the book about that. They have this incredible information network of nuns, priests scattered around the world. And sometimes they'll know things that we don't know, or they'll see it from a perspective we don't see. There's a great story that I was told when Cardinal Casaroli, who was the Secretary of State, went to see President H.W. Bush, and they were looking at a map about the Lebanon War, and the Cardinal looked at a bridge that's shown on the map and said, that bridge was bombed a few days ago. And we apparently didn't know that, but he knew that because some nuns that lived near the bridge had reported back in through the Papal Nuncio that the bridge had been bombed out and they couldn't get to where they were trying to get.
And ISIS, and you mentioned it in your article, has made threats against Rome and
They're going to go take over Rome.
Yeah, they're going to go take
That's
it
right.
over. And I know the Vatican is probably very concerned about that, but what kind of steps can they actually take to basically defend themselves, or are they taking measures to defend themselves? Because, I mean, once they target them, they are usually going to follow through.
Well, they have a security operation. In fact, it's run by one of the former guys in the Italian security business. A security and intelligence operation, and they try to be as effective as they can. It's hard because this Pope's a very open Pope who, if you've seen him, gets out in the crowds and likes to mix
it
up. But so you just don't know what could happen, you know. But the ISIS threat is not single dimensional. It is not just we want to hurt the Pope. I think they're speaking metaphorically as we want to hurt the Western civilization. And we want to hurt other religions. So I think when they attack your Rome, as they call it, I think they're speaking it on several levels, all of which require different levels of concerted action.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I read things like that, and I think, okay, they're going to send people to Rome and start bombing and attacking Rome directly. But, yeah, that's an interesting perspective.
Well, Ambassador? I guess we better let you go, otherwise you're going to be tardy. But we thank you, and I've relinked the book, The Global Vatican, on the website for today, and it's got a link on how to purchase it and all that stuff. And I think people would be let's steal you for one more minute. What's your elevator speech for the folks that aren't Catholic who would find this book interesting?
Well, the book's really not about being Catholic.
Well,
other than to point out some anti-Catholic prejudice, which certainly applies to many other religious and cultural subgroups within the United States in one form or fashion, one time or another. The book's about showing that the Holy See can be an effective force in doing good for principled foreign policy in the world and in helping diffuse conflicts and bring countries together, which is consistent with, you know, our foreign policy view of spreading democracy and good principles and trying to oppose authoritarian governments and things like that. The other argument of the book is that given that the United States and the Holy See are the only two sovereign entities that are founded squarely on the natural rights of man, not on state government granted rights, and that they are the most foremost arbiters and defenders of free speech and freedom of religion, that, you know, the Holy See and the United States are natural allies. And so for us to work together in a purely practical diplomatic sense, not religion, is a very important opportunity for our U.S. foreign policy.
And don't you think, with that being said, that is the reason they want to target Rome?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, look at the effect Benedict had from Regensburg. Many Muslim leaders have come out and criticized terrorists. Other countries have stepped up their criticizing of terrorism. And so these guys look at Rome metaphorically and physically as a force of opposition to their effort to create hegemonic control over this big parts of the Middle East.
Yeah. Fabulous. Because, I know a lot of people, when they see Vatican, they think, oh, I'm not Catholic, I wouldn't be interested. But
really, probably more important.
Yeah, I think so, too. We really appreciate your time and your information and your perspective. Have a great day. Where's your next speech?
It's here at FGCU. It's the business school and the graduate school. So it starts there at about 4:30.
So now you're talking to the guys who've stayed longer and have a greater weight to do more good.
Exactly. Well, Aaron and Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Sorry for all the on again, off again today, but we're really glad that we were able to work this out.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay, well, thank you much. Have a great day.
Thanks very much. All right. That was former Ambassador Francis Rooney calling us from Florida. We're now going to totally shift gears, except for we were kind of talking about evil. We're still going to do that. We're going to talk about the Philadelphia VA. Lots of things going on in Philadelphia. Yikes. And Kristen Rule, the I guess we'll call her the perennial whistleblower, because she's been in a bunch of different hearings. I met her last week back in Washington, and I've got her statement to the committee on the webpage for you and a bunch of other links. So please do utilize that. We'll be back with her in just a couple minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Bill, you look perplexed.
I'm a little perplexed there, yeah. I'm speechless.
Bob's music selection caught Bill in perplexed.
Yeah. What was that?
Bob's music selection has Bob perplexed, because I'm having to go to, shall we say, alternate sources. Since mine has, my usual source has apparently decided to crash today.
It's been that kind of day.
Who was that? Was that Devo, Men with Hats?
No, that was The Clash in Rock the Casbah.
Oh, The Clash.
How did you not know that,
that's
Bill?
That's one genre I haven't kept up with.
Funny how that works.
It's past.
I guess that's kind of fitting, though.
Yeah, it is
a little bit of a clash. We're going to talk about VA.
You know, last night we went and saw the movie American Sniper, and... boy, what a great movie to start with, but it really gave you a great perspective on what our guys over there go through, and when they come back, the issues they have to deal with, both mentally and physically.
I think the most stunning part of the movie was the end, when the girl behind us said, oh, wow, he died?
He died, yeah. It's she was a little out of the loop on that.
Wow.
apparently
she... didn't know about the spoiler alert that was, all over the news forever. Yeah.
Very, very well done, though.
Alarming.
It really left you a lot more informed or a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for, caring about these guys that come back. And
I thought it was a pretty realistic portrayal,
The things that they have to deal with and the things that they have to see, I think, would mess anybody up. But anyway,
for our Veterans Administration not to be screwed up.
Yeah, let's get on it and take care of these guys.
And as we know, the only people that are going to fix it really are the people who work there, because those guys know everything.
And
isn't
more.
That, isn't that right, Kristen?
Yes.
Yes, she says. So,
welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Thank you.
Yeah, we were like, hey, let's do quarter to one. Okay, let's do noon. No.
Yeah, we kind of.
Good thing you didn't have anything else to do today except wait for us
there.
To call and change the time on you. good grief. Hey, so.
I work at the VA. We must be flexible.
That's the rumor anyway. Hey, so tell people what you do there.
I'm an authorization quality review specialist. And that's just a fancy word for checking the quality of the benefit payments. So we make sure that the law is applied right and that the money that's going out is supposed to be correct. And my job is to check on those things.
See, we've done some programs. We haven't done a lot on the medical end yet. We're working our way up the food chain there. We've done a lot with the Benefits Administration as far as claims, because out here at our end, obviously from the hearing last week, you know, ours is about hiding claims and stuff. I think you guys are doing that there in Philly too, right?
We have a lot going on in Philly.
Yeah, and you have some of the same players that we have out here in Oakland. Your director, Diana Rubens, is the same lady who was the deputy undersecretary, and she came out to Oakland and found those 13,000 claims that Rusty Ann Brown reported to Congress last week. So it turns out she's your director. She got demoted to be your director, right? Or something?
I'm not sure. I don't know exactly how she ended up in Philly. That's right now, I guess, under investigation, as you've probably heard.
Except we know how much she got paid to go there. What was it, $300,000 or something? Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to watch a really good... you think, oh, congressional hearing, boring. No, not boring at all. On our page underneath Philadelphia and Oakland, it says systemic failures and mismanagement. That's dated April of this year. You seriously want to watch the beginning of the second link where they talk to Ms. Rubens about her moving expenses. Chairman Miller was kind of, let's see, what are we going to call it, feisty?
To say the least.
Yeah, he went berserk, which was, and rightfully so. Taxpayers shouldn't have to foot the bill for stuff like that. It was crazy. But you've been speaking out since, like, 2012, right?
Yes, I started actually reporting things in 2010, more internally than externally, though.
Okay.
And then I realized that the internal chain of command type stuff wasn't working, so I moved along to reaching out to the media. And I learned quickly that once you use that method, you tend to get some attention on the issue. And thankfully, the New York Times had run a story, and then Congress became interested. And we've been really working together to try and make change in Philly, and hopefully throughout the whole country. Because I don't think the problems in Philly are only in Philly. I believe they're probably at other offices as well.
See, that's really the kicker of it, is that these things are happening all over the place. So with your duplicate payments and your – give folks kind of an example of what that looks like.
The VA had moved to a new computer system to pay the benefit payments to the veterans and their survivors. And we noticed when we were working on the claims that some people are getting paid more than once per month. So we were trying to figure out why. And I guess the easy way to explain it is everybody who's getting a monetary payment from the VA is controlled by something called a PID number. So instead of using their social security number to control the payments, they use something else called a personal identification number. And unfortunately, one human being can have more than one of those, and the computer doesn't pick up that it's the same person. So even a simple misspelling of the name, or if one award is created in the system using someone's social security number and they use the exact same name, but forget to put the social security number on there when they put the claim under control, it'll create a duplicate award. And if that award gets authorized in order to pay a payment out, there's two players every time. There's someone who processes the case and someone who authorizes it. If the authorizer hits that button, it's possible then for the people to be paid twice per month. It's very hard to notice these payments. Obviously, the VA is having trouble finding them and picking up on it, and they definitely don't have a fix for it. So the system, recently, they've been very reactive, and they'll go back and stop the ones that are paying twice, but they don't have a solution to stop the problem from happening.
That's and you guys run, I mean, we've talked about this before. You run, I don't know, what, 10 different computer systems or something?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I've lost track of how many we use because things are always being substituted for an old one. Sometimes you have to use the old one and a new additional computer system, and everything has a different password. So it's a challenge. Just logging in takes about 10 minutes when you have to get into all these different systems and make sure that they're all working the right way.
That's unbelievable. And obviously, it's going to be super inefficient. You know, maximum inefficiency. How tough is it for people to, you know, when you have people who come in and start to work in your kind of job, I mean, how many of them just can't do it?
I think this is probably one of the hardest jobs I've ever had in my life because of everything you need to remember and how disorganized the system is. So there's a very high, at least at our office, a very high turnover rate. Part of my job is also to teach new employees coming in the job. We do a lot of training, and we are forever having new training classes because we might hire 40 people, but by the end of the training, sometimes close to half of them have left because they realize that this job's strenuous, it's very stressful, and the systems are not up to date. So every day you kind of feel like when you walk in the door that you don't know what's going to happen that day and what you're up for. And you hope that everything works out, but we're evaluating on a production system. So sometimes people don't want to deal with computer glitches, printers not working, fixing mistakes manually while being on a production system. It's very hard to meet all those expectations.
Sure, because to go and fix things and deal with that sort of thing, you might not, meet your quota of do you guys have the, are you guys on the points thing like we've heard about with Oakland before?
Yeah. Ever? Well, it's a national production system. Everybody's on that. So while we're hearing bad things that are going on in these offices, I'll always stand true to the point that I think we have a lot of bad managers in our office that are causing some of the problems, but I also think the production system breeds a lot of this corruption because if you don't get your points, you'll get fired. So when you have all these problems going on in the office or, you know, computer systems freezing or breaking down, they don't give you time as that part of the day that you weren't able to use the computer. You still have to get the same amount of work done. So if the system goes down for an hour, at least in our office, you have 8 hours to get X amount of points. And if for an hour you can't work on the computer system, they don't give you an hour blocked out of your average. You still have to do the same amount of work. They will usually they'll deny the time when the computer systems aren't working.
Oh, nice. So it incentivizes everybody basically to cheat because they have no choice. Hey, Kristen, we're going to come back with you here. We've got 5 minutes of news break. And then when we come back, we're going to send this second hour to air on your local station there at WNJC. So we'll have to do a tiny little recap of your how you fit into the scheme of things, but then we just go on talking. We've got a whole hour. So, folks, stick with us. We have a second hour with Kristen Rule. We're going to be talking about the Philadelphia VA that obviously applies to other VAs around the country, give you a little insight into what's happening in the congressional hearings, and take your calls or questions if you've got them. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome to We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. I know, I always want to say good morning. It's implied now. All those years we said good morning. It's over. Bill?
Aaron?
Bob?
Unless you're listening to the Philadelphia broadcast on the West Coast, then it is, in fact, morning.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But that's tricky.
Yeah, but that is very extra tricky. All righty. So we are being joined by, in progress, I guess, by Kristen Rule. She is in Philadelphia, and she is a whistleblower with the Philadelphia VA. She still works at the VA. It's important to kind of note that. And she is an authorization quality review specialist at the Philadelphia Regional Office. And let's see, I read a little thing here. Yep, August. She will have been there 8 years. So basically she provides a quality review on the accuracy of benefits payments paid out to beneficiaries from the VA. And previous shows, we talk a lot about claims that aren't being processed at all. So now we're looking at the other end of the spectrum where they're double paying and overpaying and, you know, I guess once you get the ball rolling, it's pretty easy for it to go quickly downhill or something.
Yeah. I'll bet you're a very popular person with management there in Philadelphia.
They're on a first name basis. but you weren't alone in the hearing last week. And for folks just joining us on this hour, I've linked to that, Philadelphia and Oakland, Systemic Failures and Mismanagement, and the video is up. There's also a hearing from October of 2014, July of 2014, and there's another article in here, New York Times, and I'm sure there are others that could be researched. But you've been kind of all over the place, huh, Kristen?
I'm trying my best to reach out and get as much attention on the issue so hopefully things can change.
Well, that, unfortunately, is what has to happen. I mean, you can't, you know, these things don't fix themselves because the top dogs really don't want the problems highlighted at all. And they'll kind of do anything to keep it quiet.
Yes, it's unfortunate, but that is definitely what I've learned. I started, when I first noticed there was problems in the office, I thought that they would want to know the problems, so I was reporting things, thinking I was helping them. But I quickly learned that they had no interest in caring about anything I was saying. So I had to, instead of reporting things up the internal VA chain of command, I actually tried to use some external sources. And that was the only time that I had any success with getting any attention on the problem.
Now, in real life, you would do, from the position that you're in, if you see something goofed up, you would go to a supervisor who is how far from the director? How many people up?
Let's see. There, it would be about, I guess, fourth down, because we would have a supervisor, and then we would have assistant managers of the department, and then the manager of the department, then the assistant directors, and then our director. So between four and five notches.
Okay. So you're not, it's not like you're, you know, opening mail. I mean, you're somebody who should have the ear of leadership at your center.
You would think, because the job that I do, since we do the quality reviews and we check accuracy of benefits and we're supposed to be making sure laws are applied correctly, I thought that when somebody brought up the fact that there was a problem in any of those categories, that they would think, oh, these people do this every day, they should know, and maybe we should listen to what they have to say. But it has not been that way inside the building.
Yeah, which is the most frustrating part, I would imagine. Now, you also have another, you can add another spin to this because you went to law school and practice law? I don't think we talked about that.
No, I don't practice law. I went to law school and I did a few legal jobs, different jobs in the law field, but I didn't enjoy what I was doing. And I thought that working for the U.S. government would be the perfect job because the schedule was more of an 8.5 hour day. And at the time I had a young son, so I wanted to be home with him. But I've gotten into doing legal work at the VA by accident. It's been interesting.
And you, so you wind up helping people there, like your coworkers and stuff, who are having trouble trying to figure, I mean, because obviously if you're going to file a complaint against your employer, it's hard enough in, you know, regular business, but when you work for the government, just adds a whole nother layer of complexity. So you actually do help people that you work with.
Yeah, I That's been really one of the most enjoyable parts of my job in the last few years, because a lot of people were being wronged internally, and they would go for help, and they would want to stand up for themselves, but they quickly noticed that it's very hard to get a lawyer to take these cases unless someone's been fired. There's not a lot of money in these kind of cases. So if a lawyer has a choice to do a medical malpractice case or, you know, something that has major damages and spend their billable hours on these types of cases, I am noticing that the EEO-type cases are not first choice for anybody who's a practicing attorney. They generally bill out between $300 and $500 an hour. So, I mean, for somebody who's getting a two-day suspension and wants to have, you know, that looked at and argue that their rights were violated, they're going to end up paying probably $20,000 to a lawyer to help them. And at some point, you have to think, is it worth it to pay that much money for a two-day suspension? So I noticed that people were afraid to speak up because they really didn't know how to speak up. They didn't have training in the law. They weren't sure how to defend themselves. They were filing a lot of union grievances, but that process takes a few years in our building. I had a union grievance, and unfortunately, it took about 2 years to get my suspension erased. So people started to file these EEO complaints, and I noticed that they were hesitant because they had no one to help them and guide them with the process. So I figured if we need people to stand up, I'm going to have to stand up in their corner so they're not afraid to speak out. So I found a loophole in the law that allows an employee of the VA to represent other employees in an EEO matter. So people would file their claims, and I will make a point, I never encourage people to file a claim, but once someone has filed their own claim, if they approach me and ask me for help, I usually don't turn them down unless I think that their issue doesn't have any merit. Of course, if the VA is right, I'm not going to help them out on a case, the employee, when sure. they're wrong. So I usually evaluate the case, and for the most part, I've helped over 20 people with different issues against our office. And I tried to put a spotlight on what was going on by when these people filed these claims for them not to give in, stick with it, and try and prove their point, because I figured strength in numbers would probably get us a long way. So it's a lot of work for me in my spare time, but it's rewarding because, you know, and tell me thank you so much, you got me my life back. Or one guy said, hey, I was fired, you got me my job back. So, you know, it's a good feeling when you can help somebody like that.
Well, that is what is needed in a lot of these other centers, because the folks we've spoken with before, like in Oakland, for instance, they're just picked off one by one. You know, they're cut out of the herd. And I don't know, they're either like in Rusty Ann Brown's case, she's given all these military sexual trauma cases, which is a huge problem for her since she is someone who was, you know, was hurt by that. And it just messes up her whole life, and they torment them until they leave. They either retire early or they quit or they get so sick. I love it. I don't know if this happens at your center, but those guys, if they go out on sick leave, I know at least two people who have been fired because they were out on sick leave.
Oh, yeah, we have AWOL charges when people use sick leave. And our office, they have a lot of power, so they will try and do things to an employee who, if they want to remove them, they'll give them extra work to do. They'll move them to a team that is a little harder to survive on. The things that they do to people, they don't equal what the law will say is a personnel action, so it's hard to be labeled it as retaliation.
Really?
So if it starts to happen to you, yeah, it's the law for a whistleblower. If you whistleblow or you bring up an issue and you want to argue whistleblower retaliation, you have to prove that a personnel action has occurred. Personnel actions are things like suspensions of 14 days or more, a firing, if you apply for a job and you can prove that, you know, you were supposed to you are the most qualified and they did not pick you. But that's a very high burden. It doesn't cover the trivial nonsense that the management will do to you on a day-to-day basis. You know, they'll follow you around on your breaks. They'll time your breaks. They've accused me of slandering people when I have no idea what they're talking about. But none of these things, if you file this with the Office of Special Counsel and say, hey, I'm being retaliated against, none of those things count. So
You're kidding.
I've been actually trying to change the law and the definition of whistleblower retaliation, because I truly feel that if the normal everyday nonsense that they put you through, it was covered, or if someone is found to, you know, be in violation and they lose an EEO complaint, I think that should go against the manager's rating for the year. Somehow the managers in my office still get bonuses, which you'd have to get an outstanding or excellent rating to get a bonus. So I'm wondering why they're found to have illegally fired somebody, or they're settling a high number of EEO claims, how these managers are still getting a good rating for the year.
Oh my gosh, I had no idea. Well, I think most of us know that when people come forward as a whistleblower, it's just a matter of time before, you know, they get tormented out. But I guess I didn't realize that there was such a high bar on the retaliation. That's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people don't speak out. I mean, it kind of stands to reason.
And there's usually, I mean, I haven't seen any accountability yet in my office. So, you know, in the defense of the employees, at some point, sometimes I wonder, was doing the right thing speaking out? Because you don't see, when you keep trying your best to bring up issues that are harming employees and veterans and anybody that has to deal with our office, it's very frustrating when you see the people that are causing the problems never held accountable.
Yeah, and that's very, very consistent. That's the part that makes the public crazy. They see them, you know, break all these laws, lie to Congress and all that stuff, and then, you know, everybody goes back to work. It's, anyway, nothing, I have nothing nice to say. I guess it's probably time to take a break.
Well, it's so hard to swallow. I mean,
these
managers are just are doing criminal acts, and they're never made accountable. I mean, that's the part that has to change.
Yeah.
They like to plead ignorance, which I don't think should be accepted, because in our office there's been a couple occasions where, instead of saying we did this purposefully, they say we didn't understand what that meant. But if you're getting paid on a GF scale of a GF 15, you're probably making around, I don't know, 120 to 150,000, give or take a few. And you should understand a majority of laws and policies that pertain to the office that you work in. And if you don't, at some point, I wonder, are you really supposed to have that job?
Exactly. I think at that level, you're supposed to know the rules, and you're supposed to keep your subordinates in line, and they just don't. They don't care.
Well, it winds up being the subordinates that are trying to keep the managers in line, and the power structure is absolutely slated against them.
The problems, don't get me wrong, the power is not with the subordinates.
Yeah.
It's with the leadership.
Things upside down.
It's totally upside down.
We need to ask you about unions and stuff like that when we come back, because we have a lot of questions. You look at this from a whole different perspective than we have seen before. So we'll be returning with Kristen Rule, talking about the Philadelphia VA, here at We the People Radio in 2 minutes. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. No, they wouldn't lie to Congress, not the VA. That's why we have to have a whistleblower panel in front of every VA management panel. Frustrating. You are joining We the People Radio. We're here with Kristen Rule. We've got a whole bunch of information on the multiple hearings about Philadelphia, and information from Kristen on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, so Kristen, back to you. What about this union deal? We're always hearing that the union is, I mean, not just in VA, but all over the place. The union protects the bad employees. Well, if that's true, then it should help the good ones, but it doesn't seem to do either. Like, what do you guys see out your way?
I think our union does their best to protect the employees in general from their rights being violated. And they, with the system that they have, I think they do the best job that they can. The problem is, if you file a grievance with the union, the person who, there's three steps in the process. The first step, you have to go before, if I file a grievance against my supervisor, the first step is to do a meeting with that supervisor. I don't think I've ever seen, in at least anything I've been involved with, that that supervisor admits they're wrong, even if they are. So the grievance then moves to step two. At that point, it goes to that supervisor's boss. And at step three, it'll go to the director or whoever they designate to hear that grievance. So as you can see, no matter how good the intentions are of the union, at least in our office, the decision makers are very biased because usually it's not, I've never seen the VA admit that they made a mistake until an outside party, either a judge or a case goes to arbitration. That's when they either decide it's time to settle the case or they'll admit that they might have made a mistake and maybe, you know, or the judge will tell them that they were wrong. So usually the idea for the union is supposed to be to work problems out before they get to be at such a high level. But in our experience, when management has no interest in working any problems out and can't admit that they make mistakes or do anything wrong, it's very hard for the union to be effective. Now, the union does, you do, you'll represent people in EEO complaints and other outside type avenues, which I think they're extremely successful in. But the grievances, if managers are not willing to look at this with an open mind, sometimes I say, what's the purpose of even filing a grievance? Because I know that my decision maker will be biased.
Yeah, and we hear that a lot. That seems to be a pretty common, common problem. And since you've dealt with it so long, any ideas on how you fix that?
Well, my only thing that has been successful for me is media. So I feel like the union needs to maybe do more things with the media. I was really proud because our president of our union testified on the whistleblower panel.
Oh, that's right.
And I think that said a lot. Yeah, so that was an awesome step in the right direction. It showed all the employees, hey, I have your back. I don't agree that this stuff is okay. And it seems to me that the only way to get the VA to do the right thing is when they're exposed.
Yeah, which is a tough way to run a giant. How many people work at the Philadelphia Center?
I honestly don't know. But there's a lot. I mean, I would say there's probably about 400 people in my department.
Just in your department?
Yeah, and we have an insurance center. We have a call center. We have a national call center and a pension call center. We have a compensation department, a pension department. So I would guess maybe 1,000 people, but I'm really not sure.
Huh. I was just curious. I mean, it's one of the, is it one of the largest in the country?
If not,
the largest?
But yeah, that's why they said that we had to have someone so skilled as Diana Rubens to come on our office, because it's one of the largest offices in the country.
Wow. And your ability to get to, like, the director of your office and try to straighten things out is, like, zero?
Well, recently, in the last year, it's quite easy to get a hold of her, because I think since I made a decision to speak out, unfortunately, I feel that they operate out of fear, and if I send an email up there and they don't respond to it, sometimes they think, well, when we ignored her situations before, we read about them in the paper, and we heard about them in hearings. So Diana Rubens, I communicate with her quite often. However, I would say the average employee in her office, it is very difficult to get to the director. Sometimes you have to have, go through a bunch of layers of people. Sometimes they delegate meetings down to the assistant directors. So if you really want to have a meeting with just her, she'll say, oh, we can have a town hall meeting, but you're not having a one-on-one meeting with her, and there's usually other people there where people don't feel free to tell the truth because all the other people that are listening will probably run back and tell other people in the office what they were saying.
Sure. So what advice would you give to somebody in another, another facility that doesn't have someone schooled in you know, the law that will help them. They're just a lone person out there thinking, oh my gosh, doesn't anyone know what's going on in here? What would your advice to them be besides go to law school?
The best thing, I mean, the way that I learned about everything I've done to basically protect myself, I did not learn in law school at all. I have researched these type of laws for the last 3 years while working there because I wasn't sure even how to defend myself when I started realizing that they didn't appreciate the things I was reporting. Instead, they were trying to come after me. So I would say educate yourself on, you know, the Merit Systems Protection Board process and the EEO process. But most of all, speak out. And I think if you can get a lot of people to speak out, I think it'll effectuate change. I look at our building like the Penn State scandal, and the more people that came forward, we saw action. So if you don't stick together and you don't report things, then it doesn't help anybody, because who wants to go to work every day and be stressed out and have their rights violated?
Yeah, exactly. So it is a, you know, like we always say here, you know, you band together and you tell everybody, your odds are greater that for one, you'll be protected, and for another, you'll get the word out and something will get done.
And you have to know who to report things to, because I thought when I first started working there, let me report this to my supervisor, let me tell the highest person in the building what's going on, let me report this stuff to the Undersecretary Allison Hickey. But I noticed that when I was doing that, things weren't changing, and instead, things were happening to me. And I realized that, you know, if you report these things outside, you get whistleblower protection, and the people on the outside definitely care and they will help you. I've had great help from the Oversight Committee, the VA House Committee, Jeff Miller's Committee for Veterans Affairs has really had our back. It took us a while to get their attention, but once we did, they've definitely supported us.
Yeah, because this is the third time, right, that you guys have been asked to come and testify?
Yeah.
So that's a good start, and they're starting to look into. The hard part is, you know, this all comes from, you know, this is an executive branch function. It comes from the Secretary of the VA, and Congress doesn't get to hire and fire those folks. So all they can do is keep exposing over and over. Have you seen anything, you know, actually get done because of the hearings?
The first time we testified last July, I brought up some issues, internal issues, like that we didn't have a lot of printers that worked, and I noticed that the next week we had some new printers. So there's little things that are changing. They've done a little bit of shuffling of managers, but again, that's not holding people accountable. So I haven't seen anything worthy happen in my office. And anything changed. They've flown in, I think, 18 people from other regional offices to come help Philadelphia and to come mend our office. However, I don't really believe that the people that are in charge of our office can be rehabilitated. After reading that IG report, it's pretty much every department has issues in our building. And they're not issues that they didn't understand things. They're issues where they made conscious decisions to leave mail in boxes for years, stamp cannot ID on things that are easily identifiable, call things return mail to be shredded, that if you open the boxes, you'll see DD-214s in there, turning back date stamps for mail. These aren't things that you can train somebody on. They know the process. They made a conscious decision to not follow it.
Well, it's totally crazy. We need to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back. Bill's got a question, and we have a caller on the line, so we're going to do lots of questions when we come back. Oh, my goodness. Thanks. We're here with Kristen Rule talking about the Philadelphia VA. You're on We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Kristen's been having trouble seeing double, mostly payments, though. Oh, my gosh. Welcome back to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Kristen Rule talking about the Philadelphia VA, and we have a caller online who has a question for Kristen. But we need Bob to push the button. Oh, we did. Fire away.
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. One of the questions I have, since you've been to law school, you understand that criminal acts do not involve just necessarily the physical taking of money, but can occur in an administrative way. Has anybody explored all the ramifications of denial of payments or overpayments, triple payments? These people should be held personally responsible and liable for their criminal acts. They've either denied the claim, which means they took money from someone, or they've overpaid it, which meant they have committed an act of theft. We don't know what the embezzlement potential or fraud potentials of that are. Has anybody explored that, either from the AG, the Inspector General, anybody administratively?
Oh, yeah. I actually, since 2012, have been reporting the double payments to the Department of Justice, to the Office of Inspector General. I've reported it to postal inspectors, the FBI. Basically, everybody up to the U.S. President, I have sent letters, and not just myself, other whistleblowers as well. We kind of get the runaround. The Office of Inspector General did a very good job investigating this last round, but I actually wanted them to be investigated for things like fraud when I showed them the law that when you overpay somebody, you have to collect the money because you're not allowed to get more than one benefit payment per month. And that when they weren't making people pay it back and ignoring the money, I thought that it could be a crime. However, the Department of Justice nor the FBI have not had any interest in holding these people accountable. And unfortunately, there's immunity for a government employee. And just to be clear, it's not the employees, the bargaining unit employees that are doing these things. It's management who are instructing them to apply the laws a certain way. They're creatively misinterpreting the law.
Just for a moment, having dealt with fraud a good portion of my life, how do you know that there isn't collusion between the employees and the managers? That those are dummy boxes, et cetera? Once you start fraud can, it just permeates an organization. Everybody can go into Bermuda with their yacht.
Well, the type of things that were going on at our place, are you referring to the mail situation or the duplicate payments? Or
double payments, triple payments? The whole payment question is criminal, but it can also be conspiratorial within the agency itself. You can have a subordinate and a manager agreeing to the payments and have it in the Dropbox. There's no sense that it's going to actually the person. So the fraud is not just local me to you. It can be involving 6-8 people in the organization. That's the beauty of conspiracy and fraud. Has anybody really done anything with that?
Yeah, and all these payments, when we look at the cases that were paid more than one time, it's normally a beneficiary of VA money getting paid twice, and the average employee, at least it's our belief, really doesn't have any contact with that beneficiary or know them. I think the reason the payments were overlooked is because if we went in and reversed a payment and said, we're sorry, we've sent you benefits twice for the past 2 years, Mr. Veteran, we're going to create an overpayment on you. I think the VA was more concerned about the veterans calling Congress and saying, look at this, I got payments for years, and now the VA is trying to take it back. So it was easier for them to ignore.
Christine, excuse me for interrupting, but there's currently before the Social Security Administration billions. In fact, it may be a trillion payments to people that are 160 years old. dummy payments all over the place.
These payments, though, are actually real payments, and they're going to real lives.
No, those are real payments also. They're actual checks from Social Security going to a box.
They did bust these guys. I thought I remembered this in Georgia. They did. There was a little scheme with three VA employees, and the guy eventually bought a submarine, which that was the part that kind of blew up their little plans.
Yeah, it took a submarine to throw up a signal that maybe this guy's making too much money.
Yeah, it's like, how's the director of the VA having a submarine? Yeah, it was like $6 million. So far, none of this has been deemed to be all, you know, like they were running them all through one person's social security number. You haven't found that yet in Philadelphia, right?
No, like all the payments, like for instance, I found 88 of these payments in 1 month back in 2012, and I looked at them all. They're all going to the bank account of the veteran or the survivor. It's just that we were paying them too much money every single time due to a computer glitch.
Okay, so is that, is that a criminal act on part of the veteran, or is it a criminal act on part of the managers that are paying them? Or
could
both?
Be the managers, it could be the person approving.
I think
there's
that you
no
have to have
for a
find
criminal
an,
act by a government employee. Trust me, Christine.
I just think that the employee who's working on the claim, I don't see intent on them to, I mean, it's not in their best interest to pay a claimant twice. There's really no benefit to that employee. They have to work
fast.
Well,
the intent is a negligent act.
Well, see, you got to
doing their job properly.
You have to remember how this is happening, though. I think there's a little piece of the puzzle that we've skipped. In that these guys are being given two different ID numbers. They literally look like single payments. You don't know that they're duplicates unless you match that up.
Yeah, and they're very hard. Even the IG has said in their report, it's very hard for them to find these payments. So because of a computer glitch that's been going on for years, it's causing the system not to recognize that it already paid somebody once. So, I know the Inspector General has investigated this, and they haven't found any employee being guilty of any type of misconduct. It's more of the managers ignoring the fact that this problem's happening. I mean, if you could prove fraud by ignorance, I think they would be guilty, but they have to show that they intentionally did this. And the managers, I think, intentionally didn't collect the money, but I don't think the fact that the payments went out twice was an intentional act. I think it was more of a negligent act on not giving the people enough time to work on the cases, not giving enough time to check everything, a system that allows this to happen. Our old system that we used for years, it was very hard to pay somebody twice because everybody was tracked by their social security number and everybody only has one of those. This system moved to a different way of paying people by a PID number. So you're just assigned a five-digit number. And you could have two, three, I've seen up to five payments a month for one recipient. But when you're working on that specific claim, unless you really investigate, you won't see the other payments. So most workers, they're on a very strict timetable to get their work done. If you really checked all of these claims, you would lose your job because you wouldn't get enough cases done.
Hmm.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thanks. Thanks, everybody. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the crime part and just the ridiculousness of why we can't ever seem to hold anyone accountable is making people just a little bit crazy. I mean, whether it's IRS and, you know.
Oh, I know. It's in
Lois Lerner's
emails.
Every
bureaucracy. It just seems like nobody's ever made accountable. If you get a government job, you're just, you're set. Just do whatever you want to do. And, you know, if the heat comes down, just get ready to move because they'll pay for your move to another area and you can continue on.
Oh. We got Kristen on mute there.
Was that your head hitting the
No,
light?
That was my elbow.
Oh.
Oops.
Uh-oh.
Lost one, found one. oh my gosh. Well, so when the Inspector General went through, regardless of which time it was, and they found that this was actually happening and they substantiated what you said, I didn't read the whole, it was like a 79-page report this last time, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the conclusion of that? At the end, I mean, what did they recommend now that they substantiated that people were being, you know, paid multiple times?
The recommendations kind of leave the reader up to interpretation because they say, we recommend administrative action. Well, that can be anything from a verbal counseling to a termination. So when the Inspector General says, we recommend the VA to take administrative action against people involved in data manipulation, to an average employee, you know, we want to say, what does that mean? And that definition is a very broad range of different possibilities. So they acknowledge that, you know, what we were alleging was true. Almost everything was substantiated in the report. But the important thing I think that I learned through a lot of this with the Inspector General's office is when they come to the facility, they always go on a tour with management. So when they first came to our facility, I saw them at the end of the day, and they said, oh, we took a tour. We didn't find anything that you were talking about. And I said, well, who did you go on the tour with? And they told me who they went on the tour with. And to me, it was strange because it was the people I was reporting. So I said, well, we can go on another tour. I can take you on a tour. And thankfully, I was at my desk when this all happened, and I did take them on a two-hour tour, and they ended up staying 2 months. So I think that if they really wanted to find things wrong at the VA, they shouldn't be toured around by management when they come investigate.
Sure. Well, I know that one of the other whistleblowers on your panel, Rusty Ann Brown, she had, and I'm going to say 140, 150 claims of the 13,000 that didn't exist and were told to be were said to be duplicates and multiple excuses. But she had a whole chunk of them. She gave them to the inspector general, and instead of those being processed through the inspector general's office and looked into, they were given back to the VA to be processed. So, I mean, are you finding the same thing? Your evidence just goes right back to the same people that are hiding it?
I mean, to an extent, I do see that happening. Now, their devil's advocate answer to me is, well, how do you expect us to fix anything if we don't give it to the people to show them what they've done wrong and fix? If we find claims that are done wrong, we need the VA to fix them immediately or veterans are going to be harmed. And I do understand that. It's just after you fix those claims should be on a list, and you should see who's responsible for making those mistakes, and those people should be held accountable. It's just that last piece of it, of the equation here, is missing. So even at our office, with everything that's wrong in that IG report, somebody, especially the person in charge of our department, was responsible for a lot of those decisions. So at some point, you say, well, why are these people still allowed to make decisions?
Yeah.
I can't answer that.
yeah, no kidding. That is the question of the day. And it's amazing that, you know, FBI, Department of Justice, because they would get involved at the Inspector General's request, correct?
Yep.
And that's really who holds them accountable. So without the Inspector General's office being willing to step up and say, these guys right here broke the law, we need them dealt with, nothing happens. Near as I can tell.
Yeah, and I think that you need something I see a lot in the VA is because there's such a large amount of claims processed and a large amount of claimants, when you give evidence to the Inspector General's office, if you don't give a lot, then they're going to say, well, we have 825,000 claims done, you know, in this many months. You only showed us 80 instances of mistakes. So 80 out of 825,000 is such a small percentage. It's not a problem worth dealing with. So the trick to the way that we had success, in my opinion, was we didn't blow the whistle until we built a case. Kind of like if you go and arrest somebody for murder too early, you may not be able to prove your case. So here we had to collect evidence for a very long time so that when we decided to say something about it, if the IG did tell the VA what was going on, we at least had enough to prove our point.
Sure, they couldn't go back in and scrub it all.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you know, sometimes I'm on my third computer since I work there. My computer would just have problems and certain things wouldn't be on my computer anymore. And I'd have to get a new computer. And you know, so sometimes it's hard to prove these cases because you're not allowed to take file numbers out of the building. You can't take social security numbers out of the building. You need to keep the evidence there. But we are subject to random desk audits. So, you know, there's only so much evidence you can save on your desk before somebody wonders why this is sitting here.
Sure. So having copies of claims or files or whatever, and it's increasingly paperless, so then why would you have all these copies of files?
Yep.
It's an uphill run. We need to take one more break, and then we will have Kristen till the top of the hour. We're talking about the Philadelphia VA and kind of VA issues in general here this morning or this afternoon. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Kids at home, soldiers
Kristen fights authority, they hold a hearing. But then at the end of the hearing, the authority does kind of win because they don't get in trouble. Such a catch-22.
As long as there's a microphone involved.
Frustrating. Kristen, for people that are out there, you know, banging their head on their desk, if they're listening on computer, give them a snapshot of what it's like to do the right thing at the VA.
It's been the hardest thing I've ever done in my whole life. I, you know, now it's a lot different there. People support me, but when I first blew the whistle, I used to have a group that I'd walk to coffee with, and I noticed that they'd always have a reason why they couldn't go to coffee anymore. People sent emails around about me that I, you know, some workers that felt bad would give me a copy, and they would make fun of me or say that we're not going to get bonuses because of my big mouth. So things like that are hurtful when you feel like you're trying to help. And the thing about whistleblowing for the VA is there's really no prize at the end. You have to do it because you want to. Other agencies, they'll give you a reward or different things like that where maybe that encourages people to come forward. But when you're whistleblowing at the VA, you know that it has to be purely because you want to do the right thing, because there's not really, it can hurt your future career these days, I guess, when you apply for jobs. It's been a while since I've had to apply for a job, but apparently they use the computer a lot, and they will Google you or go on different media websites, social media, and, you know, my name is all over as testifying against my employer. So I feel like, you know, you kind of put your future career on the line as well when you do this kind of stuff. So I'm happy to say now, after my third hearing, that employees support me a lot more. Even some managers support the things that I'm doing. But for the first couple of years, it was sad. I remember days I cried at my desk all day.
Yeah, it's a long, lonely road sometimes, and we hear that from almost anybody who speaks up. And unfortunately, because the support structure is not there, a lot of folks they retire early, they quit, they get fired for being AWOL when they're out sick because their health is suffering for speaking up. Kind of isn't easy to do the right thing.
Well, it's amazing to me that the same rules don't apply as far as workplace violence, workplace, you know, this, that, and everything. They don't apply to the government agencies. You can pretty much.
Yeah, this wouldn't fly in private sector if you tormented your employee.
It's crazy.
You'd be hung by the thumbs.
Plus, I feel like in the private sector, if you go to work and it's a hostile work environment, the work's not going to get done, and it's going to affect your company and the bottom line of your company. But in the government, it's our taxpayer dollars that it's affecting. It's not affecting that manager's pocket, and I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. Do you see, because this has been so much on the forefront in the news, between the benefits administrations and the health, veterans health care, do you see any of it changing at all? It seems to be the same cast of characters. The undersecretary, Diana Rubens, has been very popular in the hearings. You know, similar, and the same inspector general, too. And they come in, say the same thing, and, you know, we go away and do it again.
It's because they're not made accountable.
Yeah, I haven't seen any changes, to be honest. I mean, they'll tell you that they fixed a lot of the problems, but that their definition of fixing something is, these 88 people were paid twice. Let's deal with those 88 cases, but not let's fix the initial problem so in the future people aren't paid twice. Or we have 96 boxes of return mail, and we went through all of it, and we made sure that the ones that were claims were worked on. Okay, but what are you doing to prevent those 96 boxes from piling up in the future? Obviously, there was a problem that made all that stuff sit and not get attention, possibly a shortage of workforce. So I don't see them attacking the actual problems. I see them being extremely reactive instead of proactive.
That's a really great point. I mean, that's exactly what they do. When they get busted, they clean it up, and then we go right back to the same
bad
habits.
Yeah, it's not a permanent fix.
Habits, yeah.
We have someone in the chat wants to know what effect the new director has had on the problem. So when they brought Ms. Rubens in, did anything change?
Not that I've seen. I mean, I If you ask the majority of the employees in our office, they'll say things have gotten worse.
Yeah, that's...
And I can't say that it's her fault. I really don't think she has the power to fix any of this stuff. When you have managers under her, maybe 15, 20 of them that lack integrity and morals, I don't know how she's going to fix that.
Yeah, true story.
And don't get me wrong, we have some very good managers at our building. They're not all bad. It just seems that the ones that are bad are the ones that get promoted.
Exactly. How can just regular folks out there, how can they be of help? Got any ideas?
Employees or people from the outside?
People from the outside or employees. I mean, employees, I think, need to speak up, because the more of them who do speak up, the better off they'll be. And if they go to their member of Congress and they don't care, go to another one. I mean,
that's what I did. The people in Congress that have helped me the most are not in my district. They're not the people that are responsible for where I live. From the very beginning, there's been certain people that have helped us because they want to help veterans, and I appreciate that. You know, to me, this isn't a political issue.
No.
Some people want to make it a political issue, but it's about human beings that served our country, and they deserve what we told them in the contract when they signed up for the U.S. military. They deserve the government to hold up on their end of the bargain, and if I'm going to work there, I'm going to make sure that we hold up on our end of the bargain. So if you are not an employee that works there and you've sent a claim in, be able to prove that you sent it in. Be able to prove that the VA received it, and that when you call and they say they lost it, speak out. Because the more people that can prove that the claim got there and it's not
better
can't
off.
Be found anywhere in the building, I think that speaks for a lot.
It does speak volumes. Well, we will have to do this again, Kristen, because it's a big topic and there's tons to explore.
Oh, boy. It just flew by.
Thank you so much for being with us.
And also, the folks in the chat want to thank you as well, that you're loved and supported by more than you think.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Right on. Have a great day. You've been listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.